Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio TV personality. Dedicated to empowering others through her mental skills, she also features authors and experts from all over the world to share their knowledge and experience with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna and her guests. Here's Donna.
Hi, welcome to an hour of Mind Power. This is Donna Sebo, and we have a fabulous guest. It's going to be, we've got her on the phone, and we're going to be linking her up in just a moment. But we're going to be talking about a time in history. Regrettably, too much of this is being repeated in different parts of the world. But we are going to be stepping back into a level of time and a woman's personal journey, an American, in Africa. And we will be, Sarah, are you with me right now?
Yes, I am.
Oh, wonderful. Sarah, I want you to know, Sarah Armstrong is my guest. Her fascinating book is called The Shattered Pearl. Sarah, when I received your book, I wasn't quite sure what I was going to be finding in your material. And I have to say, it was mesmerizing. Because the way that you tell your story, I felt like I was right there with you as you were going through your own personal journey. I want my audience to know a little bit about you. You have a bachelor's degree in microbiology and a master's degree in religious education. You're the founder and executive director of Women of Authority, and you provide speaking, training, and consulting services. You have a real passion to be able to make a difference in life, especially with women. You want them to know that they can empower themselves to reach their own goals and they can learn about how to take the action to achieve the same. Sarah, your journey, your family, it was such a good family because they really supported you here in the United States. As you were growing up, your mother was a very strong woman. Your father was strong in his own way, but you had a very, very special bond with each of them. And you talk about your grandfather, who didn't want your mother to go away, so she never was able to get the education she wanted. But by golly, she sure did encourage it with you, didn't she?
Yes, she did. My grandfather would let her go to a local school. She went to teacher's college, but when she wanted to be a missionary to Africa, he said absolutely not. So she always had that in her spirit to go, and she passed that on to me. But I credit much of my ability to cope with what has happened to me in my life to the fact that I had such strong, loving, and supportive parents. I didn't always appreciate it when they were supporting me and being strong, but I do now.
Well, I had to chuckle because you said you're a living experiment in child rearing because you were rather impetuous, you were curious, you loved music, you loved to learn, and your mother made darn sure that you were going to get what she was not able to get. In fact, you were able to read by the time you were 4 years of age. Your vocabulary was well beyond that of your peers. You skipped two grades in elementary school. And when you were 12 years old, you were in high school. But you always had a bit of a challenge dealing with people your own age because you really were way ahead of them. Adults weren't a problem, but you were ahead of your peers.
I was ahead of them in some ways, perhaps intellectually, educationally, but socially I wasn't. I was an only child, and I didn't quite know how to behave with other children my own age, and I wasn't with children my own age. They were all 2 to 3 years older. So I was a kind of awkward socially at that time. But once again, my mother pushed me to go to events and go to dances and go to parties so that I would learn to be a socialized person as well.
which is very important to be balanced
yes.
in life, really. That's part of what makes a well-rounded individual. Now, when you got out of college, what year was that?
I graduated from college in 1966.
All right, so you graduated from college in 66, and you decided that you wanted to really be in another part of the world. You wanted to travel, and you wrote both a letter to the Air Force and one to the Peace Corps, and the Peace Corps won.
Exactly. I had been in the Civil Air Patrol when I was younger and liked the Air Force, and I had a cousin in the Air Force. But the Peace Corps also appealed to me greatly. I was a great admirer of John Kennedy, and I thought the Peace Corps was a wonderful idea. And so I did exactly that, sent letters to each of them. The Peace Corps answered first. And originally, I was supposed to go to Tunisia as a health worker, but I had some difficulty in passing a course in organic chemistry and didn't get my degree until the summer of 1966, and I was reassigned to go to Uganda as a teacher in the secondary school.
Now, Uganda, in your book, you say, is west of Kenya and east of what was at that time known as Zaire, and that used to be known as the Belgian Congo.
Correct.
And today it is now the People's Republic of the Congo.
Right.
And I was surprised, it shows you how much I know about Uganda, I didn't realize that it produced some of the best coffee in the world.
Yes, it does. The Kenya highlands spill over into Uganda, and it produces wonderful coffee. It's one of its main exports.
Now, you, because of your graduate credentials, you were going over as a teacher.
Yes.
And you knew that, if nothing else, you'd end up teaching science.
Right.
So you go into this environment. What was that like? I mean, we have so many young people today that if they heard your story, they go, wow, I want to do something like she did. I want to go to a part of the world that, you know, maybe in a million years I'd never have a chance to otherwise. The Peace Corps was your ticket. What were your feelings like?
I was terrified on some levels and terribly excited on another level. You were totally out of your element. You might very well be in a place where very few people speak English, and we had a rudimentary grasp of Swahili, but you're really completely thrown off guard. You, no matter how much they tell you, you're in territory that you don't know. What will the food be like? They drive on the other side of the road. Will I remember that? Am I going to say something that's going to get me in trouble? And there are people there who speak so many different languages and are so different from you. Things we take for granted, like telephone, television, are rarities in those countries.
Mm-hmm.
And you imagine things like, well, what if I get sick? Will I be able to get to a hospital in time? What if I'm not very good as a teacher? Will they fire me and send me home? What if I say the wrong thing? Because that was really drilled into us, that you are a visitor in this country, and you need to be careful about what you say. So you have to curb your freedom of speech. And it's a whole new experience. For me, as an African-American, one of the most striking things was that I was suddenly a member of the majority.
Mm-hmm.
I had never been that before. And that's very powerful to see, to look around and see that the president of the country, the judges, the lawyers, all look like you.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a very powerful feeling for me. But mostly it was fascination and endless curiosity about who are the different tribes and why are they different, and why are the northern tribes different than the southern tribes, and what kind of teacher will I be? It was very exciting.
When you went over there, you found, and this is a wonderful thing about the Peace Corps, it is that people from all walks of life, all kind of kinds of ethnic backgrounds, skin color, it doesn't make any difference. You're there to do a job. And you were able to integrate with all kinds of various individuals as part of the Peace Corps. And then when you get to Africa, like you said, here you are, you're among what seems to be just a plethora of people of a world that you should be very, very comfortable with, but you stepped into something that had a lot of surprises. One, there were major health concerns when you went there.
Yes, there were a lot of health concerns. You know, it's like, don't breathe the air, don't drink the water. You can't just drink water.
Mm-hmm.
You have to boil it. If you drink anything, it has to be something that was sealed. And in those days, they didn't have bottled water. So you drank sodas, that was all right. You could drink hot tea, hot coffee, beer, if you were so inclined. You had to think about what you ate, and you would go to the open market to buy your meat, and it was a carcass hanging up, and they would kind of hack at it with a machete and cut off a piece and wrap it in a banana leaf and give it to you.
That's a bit different.
Yeah, there was no shrink wrap there.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
then you'd have to take it home and boil it pretty well, not knowing where this animal had come from. It was very different. Also, to see people with afflictions and diseases that we had done a lot in our country to eliminate that were still a big issue there, polio, other things like that, where the children didn't just automatically get vaccinated.
And you had something where you said you were told never to eat raw vegetables unless
oh, yes.
they've been soaked in potassium permanganate overnight.
Yes, that was, we kind of eventually got over that because potassium permanganate and lettuce don't go well. But we would end up eating tomatoes and a few other things. You did have to be very, very careful, though. The problem was that many of the vegetables that were grown, they were fertilized with night soil, which is human feces.
Mm-hmm.
And so there would be eggs of various kind of intestinal parasites there. And that was the big concern. So you limited the number of raw vegetables that you ate.
I have to share with you for a moment. I talked with an African-American woman that was a teacher over in Africa, and I don't remember what part of Africa she was in. And there was an insect that went and took up habitation in her stomach, in the skin underneath her stomach. And she could feel it crawling around. And then someone said, oh, well, that's this, thus, that, so. And it came from such and such an insect. And I can't recall what the insect was at the moment. And they literally had to set up a certain situation where they could extract it. And by the time they had extracted it, it was like 4 inches long.
Oh.
And she said it was one of the most phenomenal experiences she's ever had in her life. But she said this was something that was very real, just what you've talked about. And you mentioned the mango fly.
Exactly.
That laid its eggs in clothing.
Right. Though if you hang your clothes outside, when you bring them in, you had to iron them, especially around the waistbands, because the mango fly eggs would be there, and they would burrow into your skin around your waist. They were somewhat easier to get rid of, in a sense. If you put Vaseline over it, it cut off the air supply, and they would come out. I never experienced it, but I know other volunteers who did.
Yes, so these are things that many times, I think, being in the United States, since our levels of sanitation are so much higher than in many parts of the world, we don't realize this, that things can come in through the water, things can come in through the food, things can come in through the air, like it happened with my friend. And I can remember listening to her and thinking, you know what, I don't think I'd go there. This is it.
Well,
we're going to talk about part of your experience, and your book is just wonderful. I think you have given an historical documentation here of a time in the 60s and the 70s that is just absolutely worth its weight in gold. Let's talk about, we're jumping forward a number of years, but let's talk about a man who came in to power, and I think it was in an about 1971?
Yes, January the 25th.
And the man that came into power was who?
At that time, he was Major General Idi Amin Dada.
Idi Amin Dada.
Yes.
Now, the Ugandan people are such a warm people. The portrayal that you give, the explanations, the descriptions, these are an intelligent people, these are a hard-working people, yet this individual comes into power, and within a matter of just 24 hours, changes the life of everyone in that country.
Yes, he did.
Tell us what happened.
A Major General Amin had been a part of the King's African Rifles during colonial times and had been known as an enforcer. He was the person who went out and cleaned up difficult situations, and they really didn't ask him how. When the British left, he moved into the position of being the head of the army. And the president at that time, Milton Obote, thought that Amin was just content being the head of the army. And he also thought he wasn't too bright. And Obote often said, I am one of the few African presidents who doesn't have to worry about a military coup. Well, he was wrong. And Amin was under some scrutiny for some illegal transactions in ivory and diamonds from the Congo. And when Obote left the country, Amin had positioned his cohorts in key positions, and the army took over the government. Now, that sounds very strange to Americans because we know that in November there will be a new president and the current president will go home. He will not try and get the army to overthrow. He won't do any, he will just go home. But there, if the army is with you and you capture the one radio station, the one television station, you surround the parliament building and seal off the borders to the country, you have displaced the government. And that's exactly what he did while President Obote was out of the country. And so suddenly we went from a country ruled by a president and a parliament to one ruled entirely by the military. And like I said, there's only one radio station. And so Amin was able to go on Radio Uganda and say that he had taken over the country and declared an immediate dusk-to-dawn curfew from 7 at night to 7 in the morning, and anyone found on the street during that time would be shot.
You make an interesting statement in your book in that one of the biggest disadvantages for the various peoples in Africa is what you call the malady of tribalism.
Yes.
And you make an interesting comparison with what is going on in Africa, with what is going on today in the Middle East and in other parts of the world. You say it's primarily because of the different varieties of tribalism. It's one ethnic group pitted against another. They don't come together in a harmony. They are at war with each other. Sometimes it's over the pettiest stuff.
Yes.
And you said that was what you felt perhaps was the reason that Amin was able to come into power so easily and so readily.
That was a part of it, and we really have to go back to the time in the late 19th century when the powers in the world got together and kind of carved up Africa. And they made the borders of the current African countries not based on culture or tribe, but on dividing up natural resources. So as a result, people with very different cultures and tribal affiliations were thrown together in the same country. And that helped, that made things very difficult. If we take Uganda as an example, when the British came in, what they did was, and they were mostly in the southern part of the country, which was more accessible, that's where all of the schools were, that's where most of the industries were, And that's where you had most of your civil servants come out of the tribes from the south. And so to make up for that, the tribes in the north were encouraged to join the military. And so that meant you had a government run by the southern tribes, who were all very similar, and the army mostly filled with those from the northern tribes, who were all very similar. And that was a recipe for disaster. And so the army has always been considered, you know, that if you weren't very smart and you were from the north, you went into the army. And so when the army took power, there was resentment among the members of the army, I think, toward the tribes of the south that, well, we've got you now and now we're in power. So that tribalism certainly did come into play.
You talked about within just a matter of a few months, in fact, it was March of 71, after Amin had come in, massacres were going on big time. And
yes.
They were not talking about just little groups. We're talking about major massacres, military against military. The airport was taken over. Amin, because he was the new person in power, in July of 71, went to England to visit with Queen Elizabeth and to dine with the Prime Minister of Health in England. And, of course, everything he said is that everything's wonderful in Uganda, etc. But while he was there, massacres went on, and you could be arrested for any reason. There was absolutely no law in place. You said fear became a way of life. No court,
yes.
No lawyer. People just disappeared, never to be seen again.
That's exactly right. What happened, the former president, Milton Obote, had two tribes closely affiliated with him, the Langi and the Acholi, and there were many of them in the army. Amin's tribes were different, and they basically eliminated all members of the Langi and the Acholi who were in the army at that time. They would line them up, like, for inspection, and then someone would come out from behind the buildings and shoot them down in their ranks. He was totally paranoid that the Obote's people were after him, and then that paranoia spread to anybody who had had any association at all with the former president. So if you were the cousin of someone who used to be in the cabinet, you were under suspicion. And then it became just anyone at all. So you could be in a very public place, and the army would come and drag someone out, and you could see who took them and get a license number of a car, but who would you report it to?
Mm-hmm.
And people simply disappeared. Some of them were never seen again. Many of the bodies were dumped into the Nile River and into Lake Victoria.
Your detail of what you personally experienced, because you ended up marrying a Ugandan, you have a family here, all of this has transformed your life. You're still in touch with your family here in the United States, but you have no way of getting out. And as you so aptly describe in your book, the whole economy of Uganda went into the toilet, excuse my description, very, very quickly. It literally was flushed out. There was a very successful Asian population, a good business community. But you make a point that I thought was quite significant, and you brought it up to a certain degree earlier. Those in the military, most of them were illiterate.
Yes.
They could not read. They could not write.
Correct.
So when Idi Amin threw out or got rid of a whole bunch of people, either he butchered them or they managed to escape, he put out an edict before he really went haywire with a lot of the massacring, that the Asians had to go, and the Asians were a substantial part of the business community. There was nobody left by the time this guy got through. Nobody knew how to repair machines. And it was amazing what you described, how these people thought that gold was worth so much and fancy cars that take people's possessions, their homes, and then they'd break down and they couldn't fix anything.
Exactly. All of the machinery, we had huge sugar refineries, and the machines would stop running, and there was no one to fix it. And not only that, because the economy was being mismanaged, there was no foreign money to buy spare parts. That's another thing that is difficult for Americans to grasp. Dollars kind of work all over the world, but for countries like Uganda, you have to earn foreign currency. So you sell coffee or cotton or whatever commodities you produce, and then you're paid in dollars or pounds or Deutschmarks, and you use that money to buy medicine and other things that you yourself don't produce. Well, Amin saw any money coming into the country as his own personal bank, and so the money didn't go to buy spare parts or medicine or anything else, and it was absolute economic chaos. The Asians were the shopkeepers. Many of them were doctors. They were the mechanics. They really held the economy together, and when he sent them all away, and all of the Ugandans who were professors and such had run for their lives, there was nobody left to run the economy.
An amazing thing. And this really happened within a very short period of time. Just like Stalin totally bankrupted the entire former Soviet Union within less than 3 years. This is what Idi Amin did. In fact, he reminds me of an exact parallel, but on a different type of expression, but the same type of paranoia, the same kind of fear, which is paranoia, and domination of everything and ending up literally with nothing. You say in your book, the beautiful Uganda, the Pearl of Africa, the Garden of Eden, lay in ruins at the feet of a madman. Now, he ended up being put into a position of actually becoming totally visible for everything that he was. There was a lot of denial in the Western world. They couldn't seem to accept, or they didn't want to see a lot of what he did. Of course, so much of it was erased that there wasn't anybody to talk. I mean, people were terrified to even talk. But on June 27th, 1976, there was a special event that changed all of that, and that was Air France Flight 139.
Yes.
And tell us what happened there.
This was a flight that was hijacked by militants who wanted to negotiate the release of some terrorists who had been captured in the Middle East, and they brought the plane to Entebbe in Uganda because Amin had at that point broken all relationships with Israel and had aligned himself very much with the Arab world. He claimed to be a Muslim. He wasn't anything, actually, but that's the faith he claimed, and so he saw it as a great honor for this hijacked plane to land at Entebbe. The hijackers then proceeded to separate the passengers into those who had either Israeli passports or had what they called Jewish-sounding names. And eventually, those are the ones that they held hostage and captive at the airport in Entebbe. Amin saw this as his chance to really show off, and he would go out to the airport in his uniform with all the medals on it and talk to the international press and so forth about what a great deed he had done and how wonderful the hijackers were. The Israelis, of course, had built the airport at Entebbe. And there was actually a new airport that has been built by people from Yugoslavia, but the plane was at the old airport. And they managed to manipulate the hijackers and Amin to move the hostages into a part of the airport that they felt would be accessible should they want to raid the airport and rescue the hostages. And that is exactly what they did. On the evening before the bicentennial celebration of the United States, they raided Entebbe Airport in the dark rescued the hostages, killed the hijackers, and unfortunately the leader of the Israeli force was also killed. I was there during that time, and the people of Uganda were, they had great respect for the Israelis because in their minds the Israelis didn't take anything from anybody. They stood up for themselves, and so we knew something was going to happen. And when that happened, the people, especially in the villages, said, the children of God have come to save us. And it was quite dramatic. Amin was totally humiliated. And the report was that everyone who was on duty in the army at the airport that day was shot and killed by on Amin's orders for their inability to protect the airport and to and the fact that they could not stop the Israelis from raiding.
Now, I know we're just about out of time, but Idi Amin's government was overthrown in April 1979 by individuals under the banner of the Uganda National Liberation Army. He managed to escape, was never held accountable for his crimes, to the best of my knowledge, if you correct me. And he lived in exile in Saudi Arabia until 2005.
Yes.
So this is something, your story is incredible. Your family did manage to make it to the United States in 1977. And I just think that it's a story that everybody should read because it is something that makes us aware of, one, how precious freedom is, and two, how we must be aware of those people that presume to know how to lead, and they're not leaders at all.
Exactly.
They are not that at all. And I know, Sarah, again, we're out of time, but how can people find out more about you, about your story, which I think is awesome? You also have another book directed towards women, After Me, You Come First, which is absolutely delightful. I really think it's a great, great story. Anyway, how can we reach you? What's your website?
The website is www.sarmstrong.biz, B-I-Z. And on that website, you'll find links to purchase the book, to contact me, and to know something about my business and the services I offer. So it's sarmstrong.biz, B-I-Z.
Sarah, thank you again for being my guest. This is Donna Sebo. Don't forget, The Shattered Pearl. It's a piece of history, well documented, worth reading. Keeps in mind how we as individuals must remember our responsibilities to maintain freedom, to take care of it, and to respect it as well as appreciate it. This is Donna Sebo. We're taking a break. We're going to be back in just a moment. Don't go anywhere.
Do you want to lose weight? Do you deal with diabetes, high blood pressure, osteoporosis, or chronic pain? Do you want to know one of Dr. Perricone's 7 secrets to beauty, health, and longevity? Do you have 15 minutes a day to look and feel better? Then let me introduce you to TTAP, the workout that works. For the beginner or expert exerciser, learn from physical training specialist Teresa Tapp how, in just 15 minutes a day, you can burn fat and sugar, build strong bones and muscles, and lose inches fast with no equipment or jumping. Visit the TTAP website, ttap.com, or call 1-800-342-0717 to learn how. That's TTAP.com. We'll help you lose inches, look good, and feel fabulous at TTAP. 1-800-342-0717.
Are you concerned about nutrition? Do you work hard to eat right, try to feed yourself and your family nutritious food? Well, you'll want to know about glyconutrients. What are they? These are sugars that are present in nature, however, we're not getting them in our food anymore. Scientific study is proving that these sugars are necessary for all cellular and immune system function. Over 20,000 studies are conducted each year on glycoforms alone. These are the sugar protein structure that line each and every cell of the body. 4 out of the last 8 Nobel Prizes in physiology have been awarded for research in the area of cellular communication and how these sugars work in the body. This is Donna Sebo. Every day I bring to you information that will empower and light up your life. I would like to invite you to visit my website, DelphiInternational.com, and find out more about these glyconutrients. That's DelphiInternational.com. Go to my website, go to the left side of the screen, tap on the button that says glyconutrients. MIT's Technology Review, February 2003, states that glycomics is one of the 10 emerging technologies that will change the world. Education is the key to advancement of understanding and making our lives better. Visit my site, DelphiInternational.com. Go to the left side of the screen and tap on the button that says glyconutrients. I know it'll make a difference for you, as it has for me.
Hi, this is Donna. Telephone lines are now open, 877-876-5227, Canada, 888-815-9756, or a direct line of 530-876-3222. Now, by the way, I know we've got a caller on the line. We're going to be showing you how it's done, but if you're a first-time listener, I want to say it's easy enough. You just give us a buzz. All I like from you is your first name or your initial. And then let me tell you what I perceive, and after that, you're welcome to ask a question about anything that you like. Okay, let's go to our first caller of the day. Welcome to the show. First name or initial, and where are you calling from?
My name is Janet, and I'm calling from Rochester, Washington.
From Rochester. Well, welcome.
Thank you.
Janet, when I'm looking at you right off the bat, I've got a mixture of emotions. I've got a little bit of confusion. I have, with that confusion, an intensity and an openness and a willingness to make a shift at a moment's notice.
Absolutely.
So when I'm looking at this, to me, you remind me of someone who's like a hunter. You have the tools ready to be used. You have been preparing yourself. Yet you feel like you're out of sync, like you are in a time zone, that you are waiting for a portal to open so that you can go from your time zone into another time zone and have the balance that you need. Now, let me make a statement about this. This sort of sounds like it's sci-fi, but it isn't. Sometimes we can be so prepared, and the circumstances around us are not ready for us. That's where you're finding yourself right at this moment. That's why I use the term of a portal stepping into another space of time. I want you to realize that all of your preparation and your willingness and readiness to go into action, to move, you're a doer. Be patient. Stay alert. Understand you may be doing some things that seem to be rather mundane. Do not be impatient with that, because what is going to happen is that you're going to be coming into a situation probably after the 15th of September. There's a whole different feel about that time. So you will feel like you are making the connections. You will be having conversations with people. You will have your clarity, which you do to a great deal at this point. And then you're going to be able to move forward.
Thank goodness.
You are an individual that will step up to the plate instantaneously if it's the right plate. Right now, you're sort of like a baseball player that's being left in the dugout.
Right.
That's all right. Your time is coming. The key is to maintain the sense of preparation, to keep everything refined around you, and to have that attitude of preparation and expectation.
But there's so many different directions that it could be.
The truth is, there's only one or two, really. What are you looking at?
Well, one is work and the other is location.
Well, that's one or two. Let's take work. What is it that you specifically wanted to address with work?
I have a business that takes so many hours to run it that it's just insane anymore. It's been 13 years worth of hours and hours and hours of work. And
right.
I just don't have a plan B.
Well, let's take a look at plan B, because every bit of experience and knowledge that you have with what you've done is very well placed. This is your preparation for what you're getting ready to step into. With the business that you have.
What is the business?
Yes, what is it? And then
I manufacture chocolates and have a chocolate shop.
All right. You need to ask yourself if you really want to expand this business or whether you would rather be a part of someone else's business and help them expand. You need some clarity here.
Well, I'm tired of being the boss.
All right, you've answered your question. And that's what you need to have clarity on, Janet. The reality is you may be tired of being the boss, but not really. What you're tired of is everything that you are doing. You have not decided on what to take your business to for the next level, and if you want to delegate, what you would delegate to other people. And that's very important. Let me give you an example. You have a chocolate shop. You make your own chocolate. There might be a business that could follow your recipe for chocolate and actually make them for you. You would, of course, have to pay them to do that. Maybe you would have to raise the price on your chocolates, but that might be a way of you doing it. Or it might mean if you want to expand your business, if you'd like to keep your business, you know what you're good at, and you know what you're not so good at. So you need to look at those strengths and weaknesses and ask yourself, do you want to take this to the next level? If you don't, which you say you're tired of being the boss, but I think you're just tired. I don't think being the boss is the issue.
No, you're right.
I'm
tired.
You're tired. So you need to be able to sit down with someone that has experience and knowledge that can help you work through some steps that will enable you as an individual to see where you can go and how you can do your business more efficiently. You cannot do it all yourself. So if you are marketing out your bookkeeping, there may be aspects of the candy making that you would be able to market out, or you would invest in a building that would be large enough where you then could put in machinery that would be able to do it more efficiently than you can.
Right.
So there is a whole new level of thinking that is going to have to be applied to this. And if you're willing, and I know you are, to look at variables, you are going to be able to make a choice within a relatively short period of time, but you will need to have someone that has an understanding of manufacturing. So if I could give you a recommendation, it would be check out the chocolate companies that are in the Northwest, whether it's Oregon or Washington. It doesn't make any difference.
Right.
Take the time, find out about their manufacturing. Get to know some of them and say, how is it you are able to make a profit? Because sales comes in, but the manufacturing process has to be looked at carefully so that you can make a profit. And if it can be automated to a point, you can always train certain individuals to do what needs to be done.
My dogs are putting their 2 cents worth in.
I love it. Okay. Well, Janet, I've got to go on break, hon.
Okay. Well, thank you for all the information.
I hope it's been helpful to you, and I'm not concerned about you. You're a very sharp woman, and you will be successful on any level you choose to apply yourself with. But I just think it's a whole big shift that you're going to need to look at.
Bad
or indifferent, I don't see it as being bad at all.
Okay, good.
All right.
All right, thank you.
It is a different type of thinking. Take care, dear.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. This is Donna Sebo, and we're going to be taking a break. By the way, I want to say that one of you called me, not called me, but sent me an email yesterday saying, Donna, you didn't give the information about the ants and how to prevent them from coming into your house. I will when we come back from break. Donna Sebo here. We'll be right back.
Hello, this is Dr. Richard Petty, the author of Healing, Meaning, and Purpose, and creator of the RichardGPettyND.com website. I am thrilled and delighted to tell you that starting February 7th, 2008, at 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern, I'm going to be joining my friend Donna Sebo on her show on bbsradio.com. We're going to do this every month, and I can guarantee you that we're going to be sharing new information and new concepts that will astonish and inspire you.
Enter the magical world of God's kiss.
He sees a large open area of valley ground covered with a thick green grass. In the open space are many other children and animals. All kinds of animals. And all of the animals are talking. He can understand every word they are saying.
God's Kiss is a beautifully illustrated children's book about a young boy's journey into a valley with children and animals from all over the world. They are gathering together to experience the wonder of love and beauty that will affect their lives forever. A talking book audio narrated by the author Donna Sebo accompanies this wonderful storybook, creating a special magic all of its own. This book package makes a wonderful gift for those special children in your life, ages 3 to 10. God's Kiss book and talking book audio are only $19.95 plus shipping and handling. And the author Donna Sebo will autograph and personalize your book if you request it. Call 800-872-8852. You can also order through Donna Sebo's website, www.delphiinternational.com.
Hi, this is Donna. All right, I'm going to keep my word. I didn't follow through to give you natural information on how to get rid of ants. Now, I know when I lived in California, that was a major problem all the time. Ants are extremely intelligent creatures, and they don't have 7-Elevens and Safeways and Albertsons and Lucky Stores, etc., on every corner. So they have to go out and look for food. And, of course, we human beings, we often leave a lot of stuff laying around. And when they find it, yahoo, they're going to come in and invade. And usually they send out their scout. And once the scout finds out where the stash of goodies is, by golly, they're going to be right there really, really fast. Well, there is a wonderful guy. His name is Andrew Lopez, and this is a man who has dealt with natural pest control for so much of his life. He says the key to dealing with ants successfully is a balanced environment. Nature plays by certain rules. When you respect these rules, they will respect you. So he said what you need to do, you have to understand that if you have a problem with ants in your home, and let's face it, summertime, it's hot, and they're just out and about like crazy. And you can have many different species of ant in one locale. I know we do here in the Pacific Northwest. But what you need to do, if you're finding that you're having a problem with ants, you need to walk around your residence and see if you're really cleaning up after yourself, as you should. Ants, as I said, they're smart, and they know when they've got a good thing. So if you're providing food and water for them, then they're going to know it, and they'll come around looking for it. And whatever you do, they said, if you have a problem with ants, you don't leave your food out on the counter overnight. You want to dispose of your garbage properly, because usually the areas where ants can be seen are near sources of either food or water, or both. And you don't want to provide a water source for them. Leaky water systems such as hose connections are a ready source of water. And an ant colony will often be set up near them. You will have, I don't know how many species of ants, and there are those that really are water ants. I know our home was invaded by them one summer when we had a drought. And I go out into the garage and I see this mass run. I mean, it was about 3 feet wide of these itsy-bitsy creatures on my garage floor, and I was stunned. We called out an exterminator. He said, we've had such a dry season. These are water ants, and you have some leak in your system, and they were attracted. They smell it. They just go right to it. So these are the things you need to remember. Clean up, control your sources of water, observe where the ants are entering and exiting your home, Find out what they are being attracted to. Observe their trails and the source around the outside of your residence. Walk around your property and try to locate current ant colonies. Now, these are some of the things that Andrew recommends. Dr. Bonner's peppermint soap or any natural soap that you might have will do. You don't want to use any that have perfumes in them, etc. That's not what you want to use. So you can get these non-toxic soaps at any health food store or food co-op. Also, there's an almond oil soap and others, and you can rotate them because ants are intelligent enough that if they recognize one thing as a barrier, they'll try to work around it. And also, he recommended four-finch bird nesting houses. You can get these at a local pet store or buy any pre-made ant control units like the one, he said, from Innovative Pest Control Products. Now, there are those companies that put out non-polluting type of products. He said you're going to need 8 ounces of honey or white sugar or corn syrup, 8-ounce plastic cups, one for each birdhouse, a quart sprayer or a gallon sprayer, a caulking gun and caulk, or you can use ordinary chewing gum, boric acid. He said you can also buy pre-made ant control gels and ant bait stations, and he's got a number of them listed. Now, he said once you find the ant trail, what you want to do, you want to spray the soap, and then if you can, if you know where the entrances are, you caulk up all the entrances and exits that the ants are using in your home. And any type of material can be used to close the entrances. He said he's used chewing gum. It was easy to use, and he just stuck it in a place. Obviously, it wasn't a very big spot. He said Elmer glue is okay to use if you don't mind the smell. When we had remodeling done in our home, in our bathroom recently, my remodeler was amazed to find ants crawling up and around the hole that the toilet connects to. And he said, here are all of these ants. And he recognized them. He said, these are water ants. And what we did not know is that we had had a leak. We were replacing the toilet. There was a leak around that connection. So what we did, we took borax. And I got this information from Andrew. We took borax and put it all in the flooring, underneath the flooring and around the pipe. They disappeared. They went away. We haven't seen them since. And interestingly enough, we hadn't seen them in the house at all because they were in and going in and around the leak itself. So they were inside the foundation of the house. Now, he said, when you close the entrances, you can use any kind of natural compound. When you want to spray inside of the house, he said, you can use citrus-based cleaners as long as it doesn't contain any petroleum distillates, solvents, and nothing caustic. He said there's an orange TKO, and it's 100% organic, that you can find that has a good citrus smell, but if you're sensitive to odors, then you might want to check it out before you start using it. And what happens is most insects that will come into in contact with orange TKO, remember it's orange oil, it will kill them. It will dissolve them. Now, you can also take a half a tablespoon and put it in a quart of water. Any herbal liquid soap such as Green Band dog shampoo can be used, and you only have to add 1 tablespoon of Green Band per quart of water. Outside of your house, you can use Jungle Rain or any natural soap, citrus soap-based product, which has citrus oils and peppermint oil in it. So those are just a couple of tips from Andrew. And if ever you want to get his book, it's called The Natural Pest Control, Andrew Lopez. He's known very, very much, especially in California, for his wonderful insights into natural alternatives to use to keep pests at bay. I'll tell you something. Albert Schweitzer in Africa, do you know what they used to keep army ants at bay? They used a cleaning material like pine salt. They pour it on the floors. The ants wouldn't cross over it. They couldn't stand it. They would make their detours, and consequently, animals and people's lives were saved because army ants eat everything. This is Donna Siebel. My goodness, the hour went by like a wind. Thank you very much for being with me today. Remember always, you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. Tomorrow, we're going to be talking about bulimia. You don't want to miss this. Donna Sebo here. Same time, same place, right here on bbsradio.com. And don't forget, we've got the archives. If your friends have missed the show, tell them to check out the archives where they can hear it at their own leisure. This is Donna. Bye for now.
Donna Sebo publishes a popular, inspirational, and insightful newsletter filled with information about her upcoming guests, her travel schedule, seminar presentations, and upbeat articles to lighten up your life. You can subscribe to this free monthly newsletter by emailing her at donna@delphiinternational.com. That's donna@delphiinternational.com. You can also go to her website, www.delphiinternational.com, and review past publications. Keep in touch with Donna through this monthly publication. Again, her email address is donna@delphiinternational.com, and her website is www.delphiinternational.com.
You have been listening to The Donna Sebo Show. If you would like a copy of today's broadcast, send $10 to The Donna Sebo Show, P.O. Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497-0272. Be sure to put the date of the broadcast in your request. If you are not able to be a part of today's program, join Donna and her guests Monday through Friday, and she will be here to take your calls. Thank you for listening and being part of our program. Have a wonderful day.
Houston, we have a problem.
State your problem.
Picking up transmission from Mars.
There are many types of storable foods, but how about a superfood that contains every nutrient that the human body needs for survival? 50% protein, 300 milligrams of potassium per ounce, and calcium and magnesium for your heart and bones, with many more nutrients found in this incredible food source that the government does not want you to have. This product is available in powder, seeds, and oil, and is shipped free to your door in the U.S. This product is illegal to grow in the U.S., but is legal to import. Don't waste time thinking about storing food. Plan ahead and prepare for yourself and your family now, and be in control of your destiny. You can save and invest your money, but in the end, food will be your greatest asset. Remember what the Word of God says in Ezekiel 7:19. Call 908-691-2608 and see what the powder, seeds, and oil can do for you. Remember, food will be your greatest asset. Call 908-691-2608. This product does not contain THC. Call 908-691-2608 today.